Welcome to Chatting About Change with Dr. Jim Maddox. I'm a professor, OD consultant, and change strategist, helping individuals and organizations experience life to the fullest and engaging in positive transformational change. In addition to this podcast, please check out my latest book, Embracing Resistance to Change, Facilitating Change Differently Through the Paradox of Resistance, available now through Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of Chatting About Change with Dr. Jim Maddox. Today I'm visiting with Mary Quant, who is up in New York City, and she is a design thinking and organization development expert. And so, Mary, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jim. I'm so happy to be here with you and your students and your audience. Such a pleasure.
Catching up. So tell the listeners a little bit of your background, and then we'll just kind of launch into some of the topics that we talked about, some of the things that you are kind of passionate about. And I think those are some great topics.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking, Jim. You know, sometimes when I explain to people design thinking and, you know, change management or organization development, they kind of get a little confused look on their face. But for me, it's a perfect fit. So, you know, a little bit of background. I have a master's degree in design. I wanted to be at the heart of coming up with ideas and solutions. And I sort of started when the internet was just kind of taking off. So in a highly fast, creative, loose environment. And I quickly learned that coming up with ideas and suggestions or what could be new and different to help better the world was not, there was no shortage of that. And I kind of did that kind of work for a long time. And then more recently, as my career has evolved, I moved into organizational development because I wanted to be able to help the organizations I was working with not only come up with great ideas, but actually be able to possibly implement them. And that's where I saw the rubber hitting the road a lot. Like, yeah, we have great ideas, but the ability to shift and to make the decisions necessary or change the behaviors as a group to realize some of those future forward things was really challenging. So that's how I got involved in this kind of work. And the skills are very, very similar. They're very similar. The qualities that it takes to be a great designer, design strategist, and be a good OD practitioner are very similar. Yeah,
I love how you've combined that design thinking with the OD. And I kind of first thought of that or saw that connection when I came across the book Change by Design.
Okay.
And by Roger Brown. I think he's out of, I want to say he's out of like Toronto or I'm not sure. But that Change by Design book was the first that I was like, this is really cool in terms of combining those. And so so I'm just thinking of a couple of the terms that you kind of had mentioned that you were kind of pondering or kind of thinking about, and the idea of visual sense making in OD and culture mapping. I think those are just part of design thinking is very much visual. And so I'm really intrigued about that idea of visual sense making and culture mapping. So
It's kind of interesting. You know, like? Sometimes when people think about design, they think about like, how do I make a great logo or what should the color palette be? And I think the skills that you learn as a designer are much more than that. So like one of the things that I've learned through design is how to take a human-centered approach. You don't just make something for the sake of it. Like, what is the problem that you're going to solve? What do users need versus what I think looks beautiful or helpful or sounds right? Like, all that user testing is really important. And then I think that in design, with the visual sense making, all of those skills to sort of make relationships or help people understand things or sketch things can help people understand what's happening in a whole different way than if you're writing a PowerPoint presentation or a Word document. It's more, it's good for visual thinkers, but it's more relationship oriented. So I diagram a lot when I'm working with teams to say, you mean something like this? Or are these things overlapping? Or what is, but like really making it more tangible for people through, you know, just being able to reorganize things and bring them to life in a different way seems to be very helpful. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I had a couple of years ago, I was at a conference, and it was, of all places, it was in a horrible location in Barcelona, Spain.
Terrible, terrible.
And one of the people did a session around change and visual thinking, and they had all these, they had all kinds of Legos and other types of tinker toys and just, you know, pipe cleaners and other stuff. And they had us first talking about a change effort that that we had been a part of, either a consulting project or some other change effort. Mm. And then they had us make a visual representation of that change effort.
Yeah.
And then they had us step back and think, okay, if we were to do it again, what would that look like? How would we do it differently? How could we improve it? And it was really powerful to make a visual representation of the human part of the change, because it was, it was very much a people aspect. I mean, so it wasn't like a technical change effort.
Yeah.
So
I think it helps, depending, you know, how you're using it, but I think using some of these visual tools really helps people also sort of break out of there being a right or wrong way to proceed. So sometimes we want the straight path, like how quickly can I get there? What is the answer? And, you know, in design, we learn to explicitly diverge. How many ideas can I come up with? And then which are the few that I want to pursue? So you're kind of expanding and contracting until you make something more visual or more, you know, that's more useful. And I think that that happens in these human systems, just like it can happen in a visual design system. But those techniques are really helpful. One of the activities that I like to use with people, just to get them to break out, because I do a lot of work with corporate clients right now. I'm consulting, but I've kind of varied my career from in-house to consulting firms to now working on my own. But I'm using some of these visual tools. Like sometimes I'll give them a display of about 30 different images. And I'm like, pick an image that describes your situation right now. And it's just so interesting, like how many different things people can pick, but it allows them to tell their story in a different way. So it kind of breaks out of the mold, which helps people have a voice. And it also helps us not think about like, what's the bottom line, but like, what's really the problem or the solution. It's kind of fun. Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. When I, cause I think some people would think, oh, visual tools for change, that's a Gantt chart or a PERT chart. That's all you need. And I think that that's such a, to me, it's one of the reasons why a lot of change efforts aren't successful, is because they are treated as a, as just a project to be managed.
Yeah.
And so, so switching from those types of traditional, you know, visual tools, what are some of the ones that you found useful, particularly in this virtual space?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it is different. It's completely different right now. And, you know, I spend a lot of time with the people that I work with or our clients on a tool called Mural. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Most people are. A lot of people use Mural, M-U-R-A-L, which is my product of choice because I know it best. Mural and Figma is a really great tool to use right now. But those are sort of like these online whiteboarding types of things that sort of become critical in helping people move through a space and understand what's coming and sort of have the lay of the land in a different way than just having a presentation. And that to me is a, it just kind of brings a whole new level of thought and experimentation in how we work with organizations or with people who are navigating things. And I think that it's becoming more and more important in how people in the corporate world are starting to think. So, you know, right now I'm doing a bunch of work with a company called Kenvue. It's a spinoff of Johnson & Johnson that owns all their consumer goods like Tylenol, baby, Listerine, Neutrogena, da, da, da. And a lot of our executives know just how to use Mural. they'll be like, could you please turn off all the cursors so it's not bothering me? Or could you put on the timer for me? But these visual sense-making tools are a really interesting way to get consensus and alignment on what we're doing. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. Have you used a lot of these? Do you use this?
You know, I have not. And so I need to get up to speed on it. I mean, I'm familiar with Mural, and I know when I've done face-to-face work, you know, whiteboards and flip charts are like your best friend.
Yeah.
And so I've really not taken advantage of some of that technology in the online space.
It's really interesting, you know, and what I think is really tough is when you have these hybrid sessions where you're trying to work through something and some people are on the phone and some people are in the room. We went through this a few weeks ago. And interestingly, in that session, we were, looking at some metrics that we're trying to build from scratch. It almost was enhanced or optimized more for people online than the people in the room. Everybody in the room was in front of their computer. And it wasn't a problem, but it's sort of like a missed opportunity. So those things that we're starting to deal with as people are going back to work are pretty, I think they're pretty interesting dynamics. And I think how you solve conflict is really different too when you're online than when you're in person.
Because I know that we've seen how people very much communicate differently, whether they will say things in an online space that they would not say face to face. And that has both an upside and a downside.
Yeah.
And so, I think it's interesting in terms of, you know, when everybody first kind of pivoted to this online space, I think there was a lot of talk around what would be missing or what are we giving up to do this? And we're doing it kind of out of necessity, but I think we're starting to see the upside to it, that there's some, like you just said, there's some things that you can do in that virtual space that are made not easy, but made easier than in a face-to-face environment in some respects. Yeah.
Like from a teaching perspective, what does the online thing create for you? Like, how does it, what are some of the benefits, do you think, for you or your students?
Well, I think one of the challenges with a lot of online education is it's still very much asynchronous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we've really fully leveraged the synchronous aspect. Mm. And so synchronous learning tends to be face-to-face.
Mm.
The online space tends to be fully asynchronous.
Mm.
And so I think that's kind of the next thing to think about, how to really make the most of online learning in a synchronous fashion.
Yeah.
So I know in my classes, you know, most online programs are asynchronous. I mean, that's kind of how they market
benefit,
them.
Yeah,
and that's the benefit. And so, but one of the things that I'm a big fan of is I hold optional live chats via Zoom for my students, and then they're recorded for them to watch later. And there's benefits to watching them later, but there's real benefit in attending them real time and interacting. And so, how do you kind of combine? I'm curious, the combining the idea of the visual sense making with culture mapping. What does that kind of look like?
Yeah, you know, the culture mapping thing has been coming up a little bit lately in terms of, how do we have teams and organizations actually instigate change versus just telling them what to do? And so I think one of the challenges that we've been facing is, especially when people are so decentralized and distributed, maintaining a healthy culture becomes really difficult. And like figuring out new ways and patterns of how we get the work done and also maintain respect and integrity is challenging. So one of the things that we've been doing is just kind of holding some of these sessions that really help us to, again, make it explicit. What are we doing? What are some of the relationships? And not being able to just say, what's that linear path, but how do we move things around and cluster them in a little bit more interesting way? And then a lot of what we've been doing is also using some of these maps to say if we want to show up this way in public as an organization, what do we need to be doing internally so that the team, you know, the employees are actually living those same values that we're saying that we have publicly. So we do a lot of mapping to say what is the story that's front of stage that the public sees. And then we map what are all of the actions and the behaviors and the systems that we have behind the scenes, back of stage. It's kind of like a theater to be able to say, here's how it happens, but being able to show that. So it's not just a standard operating procedure, but sort of how these decision-making tools help us help our front of line staff make good decisions. So it's not just policy driven. But I think mapping those things over the course of a journey of an experience to show not only the depth of what happens front of stage and back of stage, but also how my decision early on as an HR representative, for example, may have this reciprocal effect to somebody who's all the way working in supply chain. And all of those little things could kind of be woven together within reason to help people understand that we're all working towards the same goal. And with the same values. So like that value perspective, I think really starts to come out in some of this mapping to say at this point in the process, are we really doing X, Y, Z, which we say our values are, and how do we thread that together? So it's less competitive. It can be less competitive just because you're showing how the baton is passed from one group to the other. It's one
of the it reminds me of some of the ideas around systems thinking and some of Peter Senge's work and the idea of systems mapping, you know, what a change in this part of the organization, where it impacts other parts of the organization. And
that's a great.
And that piece around the values, I think that's so critical. You know, I look at like, you know, I'll just throw out Enron as an example. I mean, one of Enron's core values was like honesty.
Yeah.
And so at some point they wanted that to be a value. And so, but the real key is how do you translate that into actual behavior?
Yeah.
What does that actually look like in action? And or is it just going to be lip service? And so do you find yourself in some of your consulting work helping the organization to kind of clearly identify their core values? Or do they most of them already have that as a starting point?
You know, it's interesting. I have two situations I can describe to you just for a little bit of example. One is with one of the organizations I'm working with, Kenview, I just mentioned, you know, they are realizing, being a spinoff, where our strengths are and where there are weaknesses that weren't completely apparent when we were part of a much larger organization. And so it's kind of like a giant startup. You know, we haven't been around for even a year. We have a lot of pressure. A lot of people expect, you know, to see our products and rely upon them. And figuring out how to manage that is really difficult. So we have a sort of lot of traditional, coming from J&J heritage, we have a lot of traditional values, but now we have our own values because it's a completely different setting. We have much more flexibility. And it's interesting to see how we and the organization are embracing that. One of the things that I'm working on right now that the organization is working on is creating toolkits for leaders at every level to be able to have conversations with their team, whether it's four people or 400 people, about their values and how they're going to live into these behaviors and really make the changes necessary. So it's interesting to be able to not just say that this is what they are, but give them the toolkits to really be doing that. And we're trying to figure out how to have the feedback system for them to be able to tell us, like, here's my personal commitment or here's my team's commitment. And we can track it without making it a tedious to-do list, but more something that's fun is really important. And I find it interesting, Jim, because this organization fully embraces the need and understands it and, is absolutely 100% we're going to do this. I also work for a small startup, which is in the cryptocurrency business. It's all decentralized. The team is all over the world, varying locations depending on the week. And, we just got done doing a strategic map for them, which included vision, mission, values, and like the priorities that they're going to work on. And we're needing to sell it into the organization. A lot of people think it's just navel gazing. Like, why do I need a vision? Yeah. Why do I need values? Like, we have stuff to do. We have things to build. And with people that diverse in that many time zones, all working hard, I think that it's even more essential to be able to align on not only what are we doing, but how are we interacting with one another and our business partners to have that integrity to get through it. I think it's way harder when you're decentralized. And also in those organizations, in this world of decentralized everything, decentralized finance, there isn't really a lot of hierarchy. So the premise is that you don't need someone to tell you what to do. We decide as a group to do it and we hold one another accountable. So having that alignment is really important if we can get their attention to pay and figure out the best way to demonstrate the value of it, which I'm optimistic about. I am. Yeah.
And how do you get that alignment in such a decentralized, dispersed organization?
Yeah.
You know,
well, you know, time will tell, I have to say. But what I think is cool is that in that way of working, everything is digital. So like we just completed this project where we had like 15,000 respondents. We had like 14 different contests and challenges. And we were able to reward people for participating. And I think giving it back to the community so that we're designing those values with them, not for them, was much easier because it was digital and people could weigh in whenever they wanted to. They didn't have to be there to show up and vote or contribute or share an idea. So there are, again, pros and cons to doing that, but we'll see how many voices there are in terms of, yes, this is great, or this is great for now, or this needs to be adjusted. But I think that's like how it always is in terms of culture. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that those values and having that sense of what those values look like in action,
yeah,
it's important for any organization, but especially a dispersed organization.
Yeah.
If they're all going to be moving in the same direction and,
yeah,
and kind of functioning as one entity.
Yeah. Well, and it's probably like any organization or group of people, there are people who come with different intents, you know, and so you may all want the company or the endeavor to thrive, but our reasoning for why or our intent can vary. So I think it kind of helps to sort of say, hey, let me gut check that with you. Yeah. Are you da da da? Or have we considered? For us, what it's doing is helping to drive our decision-making criteria for what we fund and why, but like making it very explicit, almost like a rubric. Have we considered these values? Have we considered this priority? Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah, that's interesting that you use the word rubric, and that kind of comes right back to the mapping and the visual sense making.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like with values, like, do we want a rubric or do we just want to nail it? But you know, when we're starting to take that vision and map it into a mission and then say, here are the priorities that we're going to invest in, that's where I think we have a little bit more flexibility to say, how spot on were we in granting money versus the impact that had? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the storytelling too around what do those values look like in action in terms of stories of when, you know, kind of some of this is kind of comes from some of Brené Brown's work, but like, what is it like when you're really living into your values,
you know,
and thinking, when was a time that that our department or our group or the organization really exhibited this value? What did that look like? Or when was the time that we stumbled and really fell short of the value? What did that look like? What can we learn from that?
I so love that you said it in that order, like starting with where did we win versus where did we fall? Because a lot of times, I don't know, I think maybe it's Western society, we start with like, well, how can I make it better? What's the right problem to fix? But I love that you started with like, where are we excelling? I think it's motivating.
That's why when I came upon Cooper Ryder's work around appreciative inquiry, and even before him, with the kind of the advent of positive psychology, I was like, this is really resonating with me. And even the some of the Gallup strength-based approach just really made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
It really resonated with me. And so that's kind of been, I've tried to make it my mindset or my approach.
Yeah.
In terms of just my work and teaching and just life in general.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm working on that right now myself with, you know, for myself and with my colleagues. And I think I mentioned to you earlier, one of the points of access for making that more real versus for me, a theory is this whole thing about nonviolent communication and training people how to be more open and authentic and I think efficient in how they actually express their feelings versus their needs versus their requests. But to me, this is training that our team is doing now so that we can train a leadership team in embracing it as a management practice. To me, it takes all that positive thinking and it actually gives you the tools to say, here's how I'm going to show up every day with my colleagues. Do you have experience with the nonviolent communication?
I actually used that main book by is it Rosenberg or Rosenboom?
Yeah.
In a graduate class, 8 or 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I liked it, and so I've tried to use it more, probably more in my personal life than in my teaching. But I think it's a great framework, and I think it's really healthy in terms of creating healthy organizations and healthy groups and you know, healthy relationships just in general.
Yeah. It full circle back to some of the design practices too, but like in design, we do all of these workshops, you know, sometimes I feel like we're sort of like design entertainers. I don't know, but everybody wants to be in a workshop and be creative and do all this stuff. And the premise is like, let's brainstorm. And in brainstorming, you're not supposed to have judgment. You're just supposed to put everything out there and be as crazy as possible. But I find the nonviolent communication techniques actually help us discern a little bit more when am I judging? And like catching ourselves and catching others, like, hold on, I did that, I'm sorry. But we're judging ourselves and one another all the time and learning how to have this neutral stance and just saying like, it's not that I'm cold, it's that it's 40 degrees out right now, makes a difference in how specific we are. And also it allows people to hear the core idea a little bit differently. So, you know, this whole thing about generating ideas and then pitching an idea and then making it real, I think this nonviolent communication technique is a really nice thing to have in organizations, to really build a team. Yeah. The guy who runs Microsoft now, I know I should know his name. One of his first things he did is train everybody on his leadership team in nonviolent communication. That was one of his very first things. Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. I think I would love to carve out a time to do a follow-up podcast chat just on nonviolent communication and maybe even particularly with my students, but also with the LinkedIn audience, but maybe put together some notes or some, you know, going back to the visual sense making, what would be some visual tools to include with the audio portion of the podcast.
Yeah. That's cool, Jim. Let's do it.
Maybe what we could do is record the video portion and use Mural.
Yes.
And do not just a audio podcast. We could still have the audio, but we could have the video podcast to put on YouTube or on LinkedIn.
Let's do it. Let's make it not boring. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
because neither of us are boring people, and so when we
got
to hang out at conferences, it was far from boring.
Yeah, so it's so true. Well, and also, like, if you're having a little bit of fun, you just do better work. That's my opinion.
Yeah,
hands down.
Yeah. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Cool. Let's do that. I think that would be great. I I think that it's also another way to like using mural, even with that, is kind of interesting because it allows people to express themselves openly, but also anonymously, depending how comfortable they are in saying things. And so in some ways it helps people who are more introverted or more extroverted, whatever it is. But I think it helps you cover the range of way that people just want to show up and give them a voice as well in a little bit different way. Yeah.
Yeah. It's anytime you can make those types of brainstorming, whether it's having people be able to write their idea on a note card and then put it on the table anonymously, or the, like, yeah, with the different online tools, the polling and things like that, where you can have people just type in real time and you can get some polls and you have ideas pop up and it's just really cool. 'Cause you don't know who that idea came from. So it's a safe place to maybe throw out a crazy idea
or something. Love it.
Something really out of the box.
Yeah. Give me one crazy idea.
The follow-up podcast with the video and using mural and using the things that we're talking about.
Cool.
And so I've had a couple other people mention about, oh, this should be a video portion too. And I've just been like, yeah, I'm not really sure how to make that work. Well, it's pretty easy to make it work. I just was kind of being lazy. And so
you're entitled.
So this will be our commitment to doing part two.
And yeah, so, great. Well, and I'm curious to hear too, you know, like you and I have some history in our careers, and I'm curious to hear like if this is new or different or relevant from some of your students. I feel like the way that different generations interact with technology is super interesting. And I think there's all this reverse mentorship or reciprocal mentorship that's going on right now, which I super appreciate. So let's get some of your students involved.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, it's the idea that, the older generations are really resistant to technology. And where that first got kind of turned on its head was, you know, my kids are in their 30s now, but I remember years ago when they, you know, they had cell phones, they got their first cell phones and they were in high school or junior high. And then I remember when there was like a big change to a different type of cell phone.
Yeah.
And they grumbled about it.
Huh?
And it's just like, you're supposedly the generation that's grown up with the technology, and yet they're, you know, they don't want to necessarily adopt the newest.
Yeah.
You know, the newest thing. And so I think that there's more, we have more in common across generations than we have differences, I think.
Yeah.
And so we focus a lot on those generational differences, but I think that there's some real similarity. But I do think that, finding younger employees, they are, you know, they've grown up with it. And so some of the technology they just use, it's not even, they don't even think of using technology. That's just how they interact.
Yeah. It's super cool. You know, I mean, it's all just change. You know, I mean, nobody likes change that they didn't sort of pick to have for themselves, but like to ease out of one thing into another thing, you know, requires transition regardless. And I find that kind of interesting, like whether it's adopting a new phone like that or having a new organizational structure, people need time to adjust and to sort of make sense of it for themselves. And
And one of my favorite phrases is that people rarely resist their own change.
Yeah.
They rarely resist their own ideas.
Mm.
And so, and how can you create the climate and the environment and the culture that allows people to have an authentic voice?
Yeah. Yeah. So cool.
Well, this has been fun. And so I'm going to be respectful of your time because I know you've got other meetings coming up. And I'm going to put some notes together for part two, and we won't let too much time go by before we do a follow-up.
Sounds great. So, hey, Jim, thanks so much for the time and for just like, in, you know, it's great to have a conversation and just hash through things. I really appreciate it.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to Chatting About Change with Dr. Jim Maddox. If you want to connect more, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and at my website, drjimmaddox.com. Thanks for listening.